You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. This is Judy Ansel, and if you've ever wondered what our theme song is, it's Step by Step by John McCutcheon. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers Local 15 and Boyd, Kemper, Thomas, and Parrish. In unity, there is strength. Please support workers' rights. Bricklayers, Local 15, Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. And since 1983, Boyd, Kemper, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at bktplaw.com to contact us for a free consultation. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, it's the last month of this year's legislative session in Missouri, and we're going to talk to Minority Leader Crystal Quaid and Senator Barbara Washington about Medicaid expansion, charter school growth, infrastructure, COVID relief funds, and of course, the usual attacks on unions. In the news, layoffs shut down KC's auto industry for weeks and months. And does Right to Work fulfill its promises? Not in Michigan. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish. It's all about misclassification of workers as independent contractors. And now for the news. And this is the news from our side, April 15th, 2021. The Missouri Senate is considering SB 423, sponsored by St. Louis Senator Carla May. It would discourage the offshoring of call centers from the state by requiring them to notify the state at least 120 days before relocating to a foreign country or be fined $10,000 a day. The Commissioner of Administration is required to compile a list twice a year of employers that relocate a call center or a portion thereof from the state of Missouri to a foreign country. Such lists shall be distributed to all state agencies. With certain exceptions, any employer that relocates a call center or a portion thereof from the state of Missouri to a foreign country shall be ineligible for any state grants, loans, or tax benefits for 5 years, and shall pay back any it has previously received. Each state department will be responsible for ensuring that state contractors and subcontractors operate entirely within the state of Missouri. We talked to Jeff Hayes of the Communications Workers, CWA. He said AT&T has engaged in massive outsourcing and offshoring of call center jobs in the Kansas City area. The call center on 63rd Street has lost 400 to 500 jobs. Clinton Taylor of CWA Local 6450 worked at the Lee Summit call center until they bought out 111 workers, closed, and moved the 224 who were left to the 63rd Street Center. Now, they're all working excessive amounts of overtime. Another center in South Kansas City, off Holmes, was closed as well. Hayes said most of the jobs went overseas. AT&T also had a big call center in Springfield, Missouri, that had almost 800 jobs and are now down to 160. In 2018, the CWA reported that AT&T uses call center contracts in the Philippines, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, and Mexico. Workers' wages ranged from a low of $1.60 an hour to a high of $4.58 in Mexico, all poverty wages. 50,000 people in Missouri still work for call centers at many corporations. SB 423 would help protect their jobs, but Hayes says, we can't even get a hearing in the General Laws Committee. We're losing good-paying union jobs that paid $30 an hour with incentives that they're sending overseas and leaving thousands of people without work. There's a petition asking the Missouri Senate to pass SB 423. Go to cwa.org/savemojobs.
Portside had an interesting article this week by Rick Hagland reporting that after Michigan became a right-to-work state, the annual decline in the number of union members actually slowed, and last year it grew by 15,000 workers. This is despite the fact that in 2012, then-Governor Rick Snyder of poisoning the water in Flint fame signed the right-to-work bill, shocking the nation that Michigan, the home of unionized auto production, could become a right-to-work state. Snyder said the bill was pro-worker and would boost Michigan's economy. So has it? According to Hagland, nearly a decade later, there's little evidence of it. Organized labor wasn't devastated, and the economy hasn't sprung to life either. He quotes University of Michigan labor economist Don Grimes, who said that while Michigan was once a high-income state, now it's just average in job growth, wages, and per capita income since right to work became law. Nor has right to work had a big impact on union membership or weakening the political power of labor unions, which critics say was the main goal of Michigan's right to work law. The Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank and leading advocate of the policy, recently claimed the right-to-work law led to a huge drop in union membership last year. But union membership has only dropped from 16.6% to 15.2% of the workforce since 2012, and it increased last year. So if right-to-work doesn't deliver on its promises, why do Republicans, like those who inhabit the Missouri legislature, keep pushing for it? Rob Bieber, president of the Michigan AFL-CIO, says, right to work was mainly about trying to destroy the political power of labor unions to elect mostly Democratic candidates. That hasn't happened, at least as shown by recent state election results. Maybe not in Michigan, but in Missouri, labor's political power is long gone, even without right to work.
And we were shocked when we heard from United Auto Workers President Clarence Brown a couple of weeks ago that the General Motors Fairfax plant in Kansas City, Kansas, has been shut down since February 8th because of a parts shortage. Actually, it's been at the Fairfax plant, they make the Chevy Malibu and a Cadillac SUV, and the reason for the shutdown is a shortage of chips, not the potato kind, but computer chips. To compound the problem, a number of GM workers aren't getting the unemployment checks because of the ongoing problems with the decrepit Kansas unemployment system, which hasn't been upgraded for 40 years because of stingy legislatures and governors who would rather give tax cuts to the rich. Brown told us that some members still have not received their unemployment. A lot of people are surviving on government bonus, he said. It's somebody's fault, but for sure it ain't ours. He said the local is meeting Saturday to discuss bringing back their food pantry. You can blame the chip shortage on two things, the global pandemic and the decades of offshoring U.S. industrial production. Ford in Clay Como has had shutdowns too, and the Ford Transit line is shut down this week. Yesterday, Ford announced shutdowns at 5 assembly plants and told parts plants to be ready too. Both the F-150 line and the Transit will be shut down in Clay Como the weeks of April 19th and the 26th. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
I'm Judy Morgan, and I'm a co-host tonight for the Heartland Labor Forum with Tom Gepkin, and I will be introducing Representative Crystal Quaid. We're delighted to have Representative Quaid as our guest on KKFI this evening. Elected to the 132nd District in 2016, Representative Quaid represents parts of Springfield and Greene County. As a freshman rep in 2017, her Democratic colleagues elected her to serve as Minority Caucus Vice Chair. Then Representative Quaid went on to win election as the Democratic Minority Leader in 2018 and was just reelected to that position again in November of 2020. A social worker by trade, Representative Quaid has been a champion for access to health care and affordable child care. She's a strong voice and fierce fighter for working people and their families. Representative Quaid is married to Kevin Waterland, and they have 3 children. We want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum, Representative Quaid.
Thank you both so much for having me.
Hi, Crystal. This is Tom. And a lot of our audience are concerned about labor issues. And would you update the audience on what's going on for labor in the House in Jeff City?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, ever since the overwhelming win against Right to Work that we've had, you know, there has been the Right to Work legislation refiled every year. But fortunately, we're not seeing movement on the Right to Work issue, whether just for the statewide or the county by county that they always try to file. Neither of those bills have moved. So that's really good news. On the attack side, you know, where we're playing defense, there is a bill that's been moving pretty quickly. House Bill 500 is the number, which deals with mechanical contracting licenses. And this bill has a lot of support on folks on the other side of the aisle, and essentially will make it so that when dealing with mechanical contracting, as you well know, folks need to have their licenses, they get certifications, they get all sorts of training to make sure that those who are in the field are doing it safely and making sure that the jobs are not only safe, but well done for the price that folks are paying. And what this bill would do is make it so that a company would only have to have one individual have the proper certification and licensing for the entire business. And then everyone else who works there could just essentially, you know, feed off of that license. We know this is going to be catastrophic for safety measures for workers, and it's going to be bad for the folks on the back end who are utilizing these services. They're not going to get the best jobs, et cetera. You know, we've been working really closely with Senator Doug Beck on the Senate side to stop both sides of this legislation, but we are seeing a lot of support from leadership on the Republican side on that bill. There's a Senate and a House version. Other things that we're paying close attention to. Senator Bernsketter, now this hasn't made it over to the House yet, but he has a Senate bill that deals with unemployment benefits. And so it would actually modify the duration of time that somebody can get unemployment benefits. And it goes from 20 weeks all the way down to 12 weeks. So this bill, you know, we've seen variations of unemployment changes filed every year that I've been in the House, and I'm sure when Judy was there as well, trying to continue to claw back how much unemployment workers can receive. Sometimes they make it pretty far, sometimes they don't. don't. It really just depends on the feeling of the year. This one we are paying attention to because the senator has a lot of clout. But right now it's not over to the House side yet. So we're just keeping an eye on that one. And then there is, on the good news front, there was a whole kerfuffle, as I'm sure you all remember, with COVID, with the overpayment of unemployment benefits, where then Governor Parson refused to listen to the Biden administration and is saying that everyone has to pay that money back. We've seen a bipartisan coalition of members in the House file legislation to forgive the overpayment that the federal government did. Now there's the state overpayment and federal overpayment, and the bill that we've seen deals with the federal only. And so we're still trying to push on the state forgiveness, but that bill has made it through the House. We're hoping it'll get through the Senate because these folks should absolutely not have to pay back that money that the state misgave them, especially in a time of a pandemic where these folks are out of work at no fault of their own. And the federal government is saying they don't want the money back. So this is absolutely ridiculous that we're even having this conversation. And I'll just kind of add to that, we've had calls and messages from folks for months, people getting liens on their homes because of this overpayment of unemployment that they owe back. I had a single mom of three who owes $14,000 back. And, these are folks who do not have that money. They didn't put it in savings. They used it to pay their bills. And so, I was hopeful. It was nice to see Republicans and Democrats working on that together. Hopefully we can get that across the finish line.
Speaking of COVID, the federal government is going to give Missouri quite a bit of COVID funds, COVID relief funds. There is different, I'm hearing different kinds of discussion of what to do with that money. Would you tell us what you think is going to happen with the federal COVID relief money?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that's kind of frustrating over on our end, because we know that we are about to get billions with a B and an S of dollars from the federal government. And we're wanting to use that to fix the economy, to give healthcare to folks, to make sure our schools have what they need, to combat having this past year and a half of almost of this COVID pandemic and get folks back to work. So during the budget process, we are halfway through the budget process right now. The House has approved their version of the budget. It's over at the Senate. We, the Democratic caucus, tried many, many times to allocate those federal funds to things that we all care about, making sure that, as I said, schools were properly funded, not just the regular funding mechanism, but transportation. Small business grants. Representative Wes Rogers and Senator Lauren Arthur did a grant last year dealing with small businesses. Not all that money was spent. The department did a terrible job of rolling that out, in my opinion, but we tried to put more money back into that program for our small business owners. The list could go on and on. To be very frank with you, what we're seeing is not a lot of want from the folks on the other side of the aisle to allocate that money, and they're kind of just waiting and seeing, which is a bit frustrating when we have an opportunity to really do some good for our state with this money. And the last piece of that is the implementation of fully funding Medicaid. As you guys know, the voters went to the ballot last year to expand Medicaid, and so now in the Missouri Constitution, we have a larger population of people who qualify for Medicaid, and the federal government, part of that COVID funding and some other packages that they're sending down could go to start that and implement that. And I know y'all might want to talk more about that later, but that is another place that we could put the money that Republicans are refusing to do. But the one thing I will say, starting Monday, the House has created a special committee on federal stimulus oversight, I believe is what it's called, that will start meeting to have discussions about what to do with this money. I was hoping we could have allocated it through the budget process because folks are begging us every day for funds because we know that people need it, businesses need it. But at least that is a step in the right direction. So we'll see where that committee takes us.
We're talking with Representative Crystal Quaid, House Democratic Minority Leader, about everything that's going on in the Missouri House. So I want to shift to public education. It seems like public education is constantly under assault in the Missouri legislature. And I noticed that this session, the Missouri House has already passed a bill, House Bill 349, that would allow for public taxpayer dollars to be utilized not only for paying tuition for homeschooling and private schools, but also for religious schools, outside tutoring, summer school, and other kinds of after-school programs. So for my first question is, does this bill impact all parts of the state, or does it impact certain parts of the state?
No, this bill actually does all parts of the state. And that was one of my concerns with it. As you well know, Judy, every year there's a big rush to try to do some changes to education, take funding away, et cetera. And one of the things that the Republicans have been doing is kind of parsing that out to try to get the rural folks to support what they're working on, you know, say doing carve outs for individual schools. But this one, my understanding, is going to be everywhere. And so that's definitely one of the many concerns I have about that bill.
Well, I know in the past, generally, Republicans and some Republicans and most Democrats have voted against expansion of charter schools without some accountability procedures built into it. And I noticed that House Bill 349 passed by a vote of 82-71, which is the slimmest possible number for our listeners out there that can pass a bill and have it move on. So I was wondering, that meant some Republicans did vote against it. So I was wondering if you could comment on, you know, kind of this bipartisan nature, why there are people from both sides of the aisle who actually do oppose giving taxpayer dollars to private schools. And is it kind of also urban and rural both that are together on that?
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't say it's a regional based thing. And if you looked at the votes, it would reflect that. But yes, you're exactly right. There are folks on both sides of the aisle that absolutely do not want taxpayer dollars to go to these private institutions. And especially in these rural communities where a lot of these Republicans reside, you know, their schools are the heart and soul of their communities. People work there. That is oftentimes the only big building within a community that folks have access to. So everybody's kids go there. That's where everybody works. That's where the community has their potlucks. And so taking money away from those institutions that are so vital to keeping these small towns alive is something that Republicans can understand as well as Democrats can is detrimental. So yeah, that was a very close margin. There were a lot of deals made, a lot of people who voted for that I don't think wanted to, who spoke off the record saying that they wish they hadn't had to do that. But you know, that's sometimes how Jefferson City works. I'm hopeful that is the biggest piece of school reform, and I'm doing air quotes because I don't like that word for it, that is going to make it all the way through, but we'll see.
I know there's also some charter school bills making their way in addition to the tuition tax credit voucher kind of bills. And the only places really where charter schools have sprung up over the last 20 years are Kansas City and St. Louis. That's where they're actually legally allowed to be now, not in other parts of the state. And generally, again, a coalition of Democrats and Republicans have, again, wanted to have accountability in those charter schools so before they expand them. So do you think, where do you see the voucher bill has already passed out of the House, right? The charter school bill has not yet.
Right. So we're seeing, we're kind of keeping the eye on two different avenues of the school choice stuff. So yes, with the charter school alone in the House, you know, it is one of the priorities of the speaker. And so that always carries a lot of weight. But I can tell you that there were lots of folks on the other side of the aisle that, as I said, made deals on the first couple bills and now don't necessarily feel like they need to support the charter expansion because their agreements were for the previous ones. What I'm honestly more concerned about is the Senate version of all of this, because the Senate bill has all of these school measures into one that take away funding from our public schools, that increase charters throughout the state. All of this is rolled into one omnibus bill. The Senate hasn't pulled it up yet, which is really great news because we're on the second half. But if that bill makes it through the Senate and comes over to the House, I definitely have more concerns about that one.
Missouri's roads and bridges are reaching the end of their life. Now is the time to rebuild Missouri's infrastructure. A small increase in the fuel tax would provide a lot of new funding to do this. What is the House doing to make sure we don't fall under the federal funding guidelines and continue to receive the federal highway funds?
Yeah, infrastructure has been a topic of conversation every year I've been in the House. And it seems as though we don't get folks, you know, coming up with creative solutions for this is seemingly hard for elected officials. So there is a bill that's moving. Representative Becky Ruth has it on the House side. And then there's a Senate version that's made it all the way through the Senate that's now over in the House that would increase the fuel tax by 2.5 cents. There is a carve out for folks to get a rebate. And there's certain provisions of who qualifies for that up to, you know, income brackets and that sort of thing. But as I said, it passed out of the Senate. Will it have enough support in the House to actually get across the finish line? I don't know. This carve out is an interesting creative idea, to be honest with you. But you'll have folks on the Democrat side not want to support this because they feel it's a regressive tax. When we're talking about increasing a gas tax, that's going to hit the lowest income of Missourians available. We've got wealthy folks driving electric cars, and that's moving further away. And so this is going to really impact those folks. But then we'll also see Republicans who don't want to support this legislation because any increase in a tax is something that they simply don't support. Bottom line is, though, we have to do something. This is an idea. It's not a huge increase. It's one that is palatable for a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle. I personally would like to see us dig into increasing general revenue by passing things like the Wayfair bill, which allows brick and mortar stores to compete with online retailers. There's all sorts of loopholes for major corporations and their tax breaks that we can close that would increase revenue, that would give us opportunities to make investments, and almost more importantly, do pay raises to the people who work at MoDOT. We have the lowest paid employees for MoDOT in the country. And we need to do better on that front as well. If we want to maintain our roads and bridges, we've got to have the folks to do it.
Follow up, Crystal. Does the governor support the fuel tax increase? Do we know if he's in support of it or not?
I believe that he is. I actually was just on a call with the Chamber of Commerce yesterday, and we had a very great discussion about it. And I believe that he is. And like I said, we've got folks on both sides of the aisle who are supporting it. So, you know, we'll see where it goes.
Okay. We're going to go back to Medicaid expansion for just a little bit. We don't have too much time left, and you touched on it. I know I read one of your quotes after the Missouri House yanked the Medicaid expansion out of the governor's budget, because it's my understanding the governor did have it in the budget to go ahead and expand Medicaid as the voters had voted to do. And then the Missouri House Budget Committee took it out. It sounded like it was led by the budget chair to do that. So I was wondering if you could just kind of share some of your sentiments about that. I think we have similar sentiments.
Well, as you know, Judy, you know, Medicaid expansion is one of the reasons so many of us ran for office. This is something we've been fighting for well over a decade now. But the way that I like to talk about it is not, do we fund Medicaid expansion? It's, are we funding Medicaid? Because the citizens already told us that this is the new Medicaid population. The state constitution, who we all swore an oath to, tells us this is the Medicaid population. So it's no longer up to us if we're going to expand Medicaid. It's up to us if we're going to actually pay the bills that Missouri is now going to have for people to get healthcare. And so you're exactly right. The governor put the funding, the full funding of Medicaid in his budget request. He said, he's quoted as saying, this, the voters spoke. We need to listen to him and let's do it. And then the budget chairman decided that he didn't want to. And so in an unprecedented move, I don't think this has ever happened in Missouri's history before, he actually took all of the funding of Medicaid out of the normal House bill, House Bills 10 and 11, where it exists, and created a whole new House bill called House Bill 20 with that funding. And so we went through the regular.
So all of the Medicaid funding was in that bill?
All got moved. It was such a bizarre move. And so we did the regular budget. And then starting next week, we're going to do House Bill 21. And so that's a really weedy thing for the listeners to just simply say they're doing everything they can to not have to fund this. They're doing everything they can to not have to listen to the voters. And we stood on that House floor last week where I heard again elected officials saying that the voters were confused and they didn't understand it. They were fed a lie, et cetera, et cetera. There's no money. My response back to that is that they are lying. We have billions of dollars, as we've already discussed, from the federal government ready to pay for this. There's a specific new provision from the Biden administration for states who have not expanded Medicaid yet to get additional funds. They're going to additionally give us more money. Instead of the 90-10 match, we're going to get even more than that for the first couple of years. And then, you know, with expansion as a whole, we see a huge increase of the federal reimbursement for what we're spending as a state. And so there is no argument to be made that we don't have the money to do this. It will save us money, and there's more than enough money to start up right now. At this point, you know, we're hopeful that the Senate will put it back in, that the Senate will act like the adults in the room and listen to the voters and actually do what we can do for people. And then at that point, it'll be a battle between the House and Senate. If the Senate refuses to do it, then what can happen is the department then can kind of do one of two things. The department could simply say, okay, here's the new Medicaid population that we have. We have a smaller bucket of money than we need. And so we're going to pay for what we've got. And then when a bill starts to rack up, they come back to the Missouri legislature and ask for what's known as a supplemental budget bill, where they just say, hey, we need more money. That would be the ideal situation if we don't fund it the way we're supposed to, if we ignore the Constitution and do it this way. Or the department could simply say, there's not enough money to do this. and they don't cover the new population. At that point, we would go to the courts and the courts would decide whether or not we have to pay for it. I hope it doesn't go to that point. We shouldn't be wasting taxpayer dollars in court for something that the Constitution is telling us to do.
Really sorry we've run out of time, but we so appreciate your time with us. It goes so fast, but we really appreciate you being with us this evening on Heartland Labor Forum, and we especially appreciated your keen insight into what's happening in the Missouri House of Representatives. Thank you so much, Representative Quaid.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Every Friday morning at 9:30, you can hear Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. Historically mired in misinformation and cloaked in the chaos of controversy, the realities that prevail in that much-too-promised land and the U.S. policies, therefore, call out to be addressed in a calm yet delving fact-based fashion. Tune in on Friday mornings at 9:30 to listen to scholars, journalists, analysts, and activists who help us to understand the peoples and politics of and the possibilities for Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls.
Thanks for listening to KKFI. Be sure to like and follow your community radio station on social media at KKFI 901 FM. And thanks for 30 years of support.
Senator Barbara Washington represents the Kansas City's 9th District. Prior to that, she served in the Missouri House for 3 years. She supports her district in many ways: small business development, juvenile justice reform, minority mental health awareness and crime reduction, and works to preserve the environment. Senator Washington is a practicing attorney, a graduate of the University of Missouri Columbia School of Journalism. She earned her MBA from Avila University and her Juris Doctorate from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, Senator Washington.
Evening, sorry. Thank you guys for having me. I'm honored to be here with one of the most important workforces that exists, especially in Kansas City, and that is our union brothers and sisters. So thank you for having me.
This is a labor show. Would you give us an update on what is happening in the Senate concerning right to work?
Well, you know, we have Senate Bill 244. And if we think back, this is just an extension of what I believe is a bad bill that passed in my first year, which was House Bill 1314. If we recall, House Bill 1314 required public employers to get permission before taking out union dues from any public union employees. So now Senate Bill 244 is going even further and saying that before you can take out dues from public union employees, the union has to submit an authorization to the employer. And then you have to pretty much prove to the employer that you didn't coerce or force the employee to sign the authorization. So unfortunately, it was voted out of committee 5-2, and it currently sits on the calendar at I think number 70 something for perfection, which means that it is on the floor to be argued at some point. So that's the main thing that's going on the Senate side right now. So it's in my opinion, it's just another tool to try to break down who we are as who folks are as union workers, which are the backbone of our working system.
Hi, Senator Washington. Judy Morgan here, and it's good to talk to you again. I haven't seen you in a while. That kind of follows up into, I wanted to talk about that Senate Bill 244. I remember that House bill when I was there in the legislature, and it passed and was signed by the governor, but the courts threw it out, or it's being held up in courts, I believe. So basically the legislature's trying again at this, right? Even though it's right now being held up in the courts.
Correct. But that would be the Missouri legislature. the way it is right now, it doesn't matter what the courts say or the people, they're going to continue. You know, the the bothersome part is that this state passed right to work. I'm sorry, we defeated right to work. And so that means that the people that sent us here want the freedom to be able to join a union. So this doesn't seem to necessarily be coming from the people, but could be, you know, coming from those who definitely don't want us to want folks to unionize. And so that's why it's a bill I can't support.
Thank you. Well, you said it was 70 on the calendar, but could they pull it up at any time? Could they pull it up at any time?
So what has it appears to me that what we do over there, and I'm new, as you know, is we go in order.
Okay.
We're not like the House where they pick and choose. We go in order. However, sometimes the floor leader may say lay the bill over or to the informal calendar. So it could, you know, it doesn't mean that we're going to hear it in order, but it does mean he calls them in order.
We'll hope that one stays on the calendar and doesn't come up to the floor for a vote.
75 is down pretty far.
Because we're down to about close to the last, 4 or 5 weeks of the session.
I think we have 22 days left in session. So I think we have, we have 22 days. Someone reminded me that yesterday. 2 weeks in May and 962, I think 3 weeks. So 5 weeks.
I think Tom has the next question.
Yes, ma'am. Missouri is going to receive money from the federal government for COVID-19 relief. This money will help businesses and families get back on their feet or stay afloat. What are the plans in the Senate for this COVID relief money?
So I think the plans are to continue to do what was done with the initial money, and that is to help out with those areas that are most at need. We have not began that full discussion in the Senate yet, but we want to help with infrastructure, help those cities and counties that didn't qualify for funding directly, help them with housing, with food, definitely put a lot of money back in education. So, and we're putting a lot of money into the unemployment arena, into the unemployment pocket as well, to make sure that we can help those who are most at need. It's not going to be 100% of what everyone wants, but we are going to follow the rules as to what CARES is for. A lot into education. I did see the House put several millions of dollars into higher ed. I was reviewing the higher ed bill today, actually. So we're going to also make sure that we're helping with our higher ed educational institution too. Lost a lot of tuition and lost a lot of people. That enrollment was down even more, and also help our K-12, which is important as well.
There is some discussion about tax refunds. What are your feelings on that, and is it going to go anywhere?
What I think is probably more probable is that your COVID relief money, your stimulus, will not be taxed by the state of Missouri, is the prevailing thought.
Okay. We're talking with Senator Barbara Washington about what is happening in the Senate in Jeff City.
Barbara, one of the issues I know that's near and dear to both of us and to many of the people we've both represented is Medicaid expansion. And we talked about it in the first half of our show with Democratic Minority Leader Crystal Quaid and how the Missouri House just recently torpedoed the funding for Medicaid expansion, despite the recent, the vote of the people who said they wanted it. So the Medicaid expansion, even though the governor supported it, it's been taken out of the House budget. So I believe the Senate's over on the budget is over on the Senate side now for your deliberations. So what do you think the chances are that the Senate will reinstate the funding for Medicaid expansion to expand it?
Well, I will say that I pray that the Appropriations Committee puts it back in. I'm on that committee. I definitely will be voting to put it in. I don't think I'll be the only one, and I don't think it'll be strictly party lines. However, as you know from being in this building, term limits means that other people that work in our government relations arena in the building have a little more information than we do. And so there is a fear right now that we won't put it back in. And so maybe, and then that may throw it back on the governor's responsibility. And I apologize, I have not checked the legality of whether he can put it back in. So there's also a thought that we'll put the money in, but it'll be different than the way it is. So what one of the reasons I think it was easy for the House to pull it out was they made it a separate House bill, and Medicaid doesn't Medicaid in and of itself is not usually just a separate house bill of itself. They made the expansion a separate house bill, so that way you can end that without moving forward. And I think that's what happened in the House. I am disappointed that something that our voters approved, I don't care if it was 50.1, we voted for it. I am disappointed that here again, we are in the building and going against the will of our voters. We did that with right to work, minimum wage, and now we're also doing it with Medicaid expansion, and we did that with Clean Missouri. And the other thing is, you know, I have a tremendous amount of family that still lives in rural Missouri. And when hospitals are not available for them, because we've closed, I think, 14 in the last 10 years, Medicaid expansion would help some of those hospitals come back to life. And it's not expanding to people that are just sitting at home. Medicaid expansion means people who earn over a certain amount can now qualify because they're working such low income jobs. They can't afford to buy insurance on their own. And they're working the type of jobs that are not providing them coverage. So this is a much needed resource for us. On top of the fact we're leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table, because if we don't expand, the federal government won't give us money. So it is ludicrous to me that we leave that money on the table when we could help approximately 250 more thousand Missourians.
So Senator Washington, one thing it's not quite clear in my head. If we do not expand Medicaid within our budget, does that mean we lose all of our Medicaid funding completely? Or is it just that we lose the portion that would have expanded Medicaid to those who make up to 138% of the federal poverty level?
Right now, my understanding is we would not lose all of our Medicaid funding, just the expansion portion that we could have been getting for years. Know that if we do not do this, we're going to lose additional money because we're going to pay legal fees to fight this, and it's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Let's switch to charter schools and vouchers. In the first half of the show, we talked about how the Missouri House of Representatives narrowly passed House Bill 349, a bill that would allow for public taxpayer dollars to be utilized not only for paying tuition for homeschooling and private schools, but also for outside tutoring, summer school, and other school programs. The Missouri Senate actually debated a similar, although much more expansive, education bill for nearly 12 hours. And at the last I had read, it had been tabled without a vote. So could you talk, it's Senate Bill 55, which sounds like it's a big education bill that includes tuition tax credits for private and religious schools. Could you first kind of talk about what's in that bill? And then I have couple of other questions after that.
So in addition to the empowerment scholarship accounts, which are somewhat similar to vouchers, we have some charter school expansion. As you know, from being a great member of the House for 9 years, that's been up for debate for over 20 years. This expansion would expand to cities that have more than 30,000 people. It would allow expansion to even continue once a unaccredited district became accredited. And it actually prevents the city of St. Louis, the St. Louis public school system, from restricting the building use and not selling to charter schools or leasing to charter schools. And then there's an issue about charter school additional funding from our local taxes. Senate Bill 55 would establish a charter school public school commission. It would revise how school districts are accredited. It would establish a gifted education program. It would change the way the state determines our weighted daily average attendance, which is how the state allocates how much money goes to each district. It has a reading success portion. It requires that school districts allow homeschool children to participate in school sports. There's a portion that will allow an option for the Hebrew portion of the Bible to be taught, I believe, as an elective. And then there's some elements of some in-school attendance calculation. So it is
they threw about every possible education policy into that one bill, it sounds like.
Yeah, so it is a conglomeration of, so for those who don't realize what we do, although I think a lot of your listeners will, It's what we call an omnibus bill, and it pulled together several bills related to education here in the Senate. And they pulled together all the bills that they liked, of course, to make this one bill, Senate Bill 55. In fact, Senate Bill 55 is at least, it's 55, 23, 25, and then a bunch of other portions of other bills.
It's my understanding that a bipartisan group of senators, both Republicans and Democrats, did oppose the bill, especially the sending public dollars to the private homeschool and religious schools. Is that accurate? And did some of the opposition come from senators who represented rural areas of the state?
That is absolutely correct. So there are some concerns about how this money is spent. I think that the voucher or education empowerment savings accounts is probably the least controversial. It does not have, it doesn't have a lot of support, but it probably has the most support. The charter expansion at 30,000 rural communities would probably okay that, but we tabled that bill or set it over because it probably didn't have the votes at that time. And we had 12 hours of discussion, and I'm sure when and if it comes back, I do believe it will come back. It is Senator O'Loughlin's, that is her cherry pick, that this is her mission. She's about education. I think it will come back, but I don't know where the votes stand right now, but it will probably be another 12-hour marathon of debating this bill.
Did some Republicans actually get up on the floor and help with the debate?
I don't think they consider themselves helping us, but there were both sides had debated, not just the, you know, ultra conservative people, but Republicans from throughout the state. There were lots of people that opposed the bill.
Okay. Well, thank you for your explanation of that.
In about 2.5 minutes that we have left, infrastructure is especially important to working families and union members who build things. Missouri has one of the largest highway systems in the nation, and it's ranked 49th in fuel taxes. Senate Bill 262 is on its way, has passed the Senate, and it's on its way to the House. Will you discuss in the short time we have left what's in this bill and what is the likely to come back from the House?
I think the House is not going to leave it like it is. There are some challenges in it, but all in all, we need money. We need money to fix our roads. Every week I cross the Roachport Bridge twice, once to go to Jefferson City and once to come back. If I want to go to my beloved Mizzou for a football game, I cross that bridge. I use that bridge as an example because it is heavily traveled and it needs repair. And we have other bridges that need repair as well. We have roads that need repair. So we would take some money from that. It's a usage tax, a motor fuel tax, that would help give us some funding for our roads. Now I'm gonna have to be hypocritical here, because again, the people said no to this. This did go before the voters about having a motor fuel tax, and it did not necessarily pass. So this is something that should have some challenges from the people, but I believe that we need something that's going to help us. And if it's something that will get us out of number 49 in the state, then that's what we need to do. We have not raised our taxes and for that since 1996, I believe. And so we rejected a 10% increase in the 28 election. And I think this increase is much smaller and hopefully would be something that our voters would approve if they need to. It passed out of the Senate, but you know, I think there's definitely going to be some challenges. There are a lot more voices in the House. So it's over to the House, and I am not sure where it is on their calendar right now. I take that back. It's been second read in the House, so it has not been assigned to a committee. And you pretty much, to get some things going across the board, they need to be getting to committees here in the next 10 days.
So do you think that they would just let it die?
If it's something that is not wanted on the House side, absolutely, they would let it die. Because even when something's been referred to committee, you have a hearing, it gets out of that basic committee, which is a substantive committee, that's a subject committee, then goes to what we call a rules committee. it can come to the floor and still not, because it's up to the floor leader and the speaker to make that determination as to what their priorities are and what bills they want heard.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thank you, Senator Washington. Thanks for taking the time to come on the Heartland Labor Forum and to tell us what's happening in the Missouri Senate. We sure appreciate it.
Good to talk to you.
And thank you for all the work you do.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Get up. Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. This is Michael Amash with the law firm of Blake & Ulig. This month I'm going to discuss with you a topic that impacts every single person in this country, worker misclassification. Worker misclassification is nothing new. However, the misclassification of workers has become increasingly pervasive over the last few decades. In addition, it has become a fertile topic for conversation and attention as a result of the rise of the gig economy. The repercussions of whether a worker is determined to be an employee or an independent contractor are significant to the worker and the company's competitors, and the taxpayer. There are a host of laws that provide safeguards for workers that do not apply to an independent contractor. To name a few, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which creates the federal minimum wage and overtime requirements, the National Labor Relations Act, which provides a worker the ability to join or form a union. In addition, independent contractors are now covered by workers' compensation laws, unemployment insurance laws, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, and the Family and Medical Leave Act. So what makes someone an independent contractor versus an employee? The law looks to a number of different factors, no single one of which is dispositive. Instead, the law and courts look to the total activity of the individual performing the work and their relationship to the company on whose behalf the work is performed. Factors include, but are not limited to, whether the hired party, the worker, exercises true independence in determining basic features of the relationship, like rates of pay, how and where tasks are done, and the opportunities for expanding or contracting that work based on the individual's own skills, abilities, and enterprise. Courts will look to the permanency of the relationship, the nature and degree of control by the company, the degree of independent business organization and operation exercised by the individual. In addition, courts will look to whether the, quote, independent contractor makes decisions and takes actions that have a significant impact on their opportunity for profits or losses. As I said, this is not an exhaustive list, but the highlight of it is who is exercising control and to what extent is the quote-unquote independent contractor exercising independent judgment. Now, when workers have little actual control over their work but are misclassified as independent contractors, their losses can be significant. They can end up, in actuality, earning below the federal minimum wage, and they're denied overtime compensation. Now, these are significant issues to the individual, but these issues go beyond just those impacting that individual themselves. A person who should be considered an employee, but is actually misclassified as an independent contractor, is not making full contributions, and the employer is not making full contributions to unemployment insurance and workers' compensation programs. It impacts what is paid in payroll taxes to federal and state governments. And so in this way, as I said in the opening, the misclassification of workers doesn't just impact those individuals in the company, they impact every single person in this country. In addition, the misclassification of worker impacts competition and can create competition imbalances between competitive companies. Take, for example, UPS and FedEx. Everybody knows who UPS and FedEx are, and many of you know where I'm going with this. FedEx has used various independent contractor schemes in its ground and home delivery division, and they've done it for years. This means that individuals labeled as independent contractors are not afforded the protections that we previously discussed. Now, it should be noted that FedEx has been the subject of dozens of class action lawsuits with varying results. Those class actions alleging that the drivers for its ground and home delivery divisions have been misclassified as independent contractors. Now compare FedEx use of independent contractors with UPS, who, as many of you are aware, has a nationwide collective bargaining agreement with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, an agreement that acknowledges those individuals doing same or similar work as FedEx as independent contractors as employees and provides them with pay, benefits, and protections of a collective bargaining agreement, protections FedEx workers cannot obtain so long as they are deemed independent contractors. Now, FedEx is not alone. The use of independent contractors to undermine workers and avoid compliance with federal laws has been utilized in trucking, construction, janitorial industry for decades. Now, there is new questions and controversies with the rise of the gig economy, whether it be Uber, DoorDash, or any of the now hundreds of app-based services becoming increasingly prominent in our society. The question for all of us is, what impact will this have on our economy when the employer-employee construct is broken down and undermined and workers no longer have the legal protections and benefits of the traditional employment relationships? What ability does a quote, independent contractor have to push back against Uber, FedEx, or any other large multinational corporation? Questions to consider. Until next month, this is Mike Amash with Blake and Ulig, and Know Your Rights.
And this is Judy Ansel with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. The Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast with guest speakers Representative Sharice Davids, Kansas Representative Tom Burrows, and UMKC Political Science Professor Emeritus Max Kidmore will be Saturday, April 17th at 9 a.m. on Zoom. And you can go to the Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast Facebook page for a link. All Souls Unitarian Forum, the Institute of Local Self-Reliance with Brenda Platt and Neil Seldman, Sunday at 10 a.m. And go to allsoulskc.org for the Zoom link. There's going to be a May Day celebration to demand that Missouri senators vote for the PRO Act. It's going to be on May Day, Saturday, May 1st, 10 a.m., Eilis Davis Park, 10th and Oak in Kansas City, Missouri. This is endorsed, part of a national AFL-CIO mobilization, endorsed by the local Kansas City AFL-CIO, by the Coalition of Labor Union Women, and others. And finally, the Polk School, a two-day labor leadership training for women workers, June 24th to 26th at the University of Illinois Chicago campus. You can register. Scholarships are available. The deadline to apply is May 21st. And you can register by looking up Regina V. Polk Women's Labor Leadership Conference. All of these are on our Facebook page if you want to find the link. And our Facebook page is the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Check it out. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to spend the hour with Jane McAlevey, who just wrote a book called A Collective Bargain, Unions, Organizing, and the Fight for Democracy. Jane is probably the most articulate labor organizer in the country right now. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman.
We are the working class, and that's the
listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.